Hey, FFR listeners, this is Rob Pera. I edit the podcast and just wanted to give you a quick heads up. Today's guest's computer had a couple little audio recording glitches. Nothing too crazy, but just wanted to give you a heads up that it isn't your device. Don't throw your iPhone out the window or anything. Okay, on with the show.
Hey friends, did you know that Feminist Frequency recently launched the Games and Online Harassment Hotline? Well, we sure did. It is a confidential, text-based emotional support resource for folks who make and play games. You can learn more at gameshotline.org, and please, please help us spread the word so we can reach the people who need it the most.
As much as I didn't, you know, personally, like, put on my sleigh bells and go marching around the house for this movie, I'm nevertheless glad that it exists, you know? In an ideal world, we have so many queer stories on screen that there we have room for the, you know, the mediocre, the fair to middling, the, oh, I'll put this on in the background, but I'm not really paying attention to it, you know?
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love. I'm Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined today by two overachieving gift basket curators, Ebony Adams.
What's up?
And our first time guest, Dave Proctor.
I'm not as smart as Carolyn.
None of us are.
None of us are. Carolyn is busy trying to find some new fish to replace the old ones that she killed, so Dave is joining us as a special guest. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Anita. Hello,
I love that Carolyn couldn't join us kind of last minute. And I was like, who should I invite to talk about a queer holiday rom-com? What about a straight white dude?
Straight white dude who can speak deeply to the suburban experience of this film.
There you go.
Well, at least you have that. So this week, we're going to be talking about Happiest Season, a queer holiday rom-com now available on Hulu. Stay tuned. Okay, y'all, before we get into everything, I would like to ask for your help, because this week we're kicking off our end-of-year fundraising campaign for Feminist Frequency. This campaign is a really important one for us because 2020 has been extra hard for everyone, and nonprofits really scrambled to stay alive. We've been cutting programs, going entirely online, losing grants and other previously promised funding sources, and nonprofits were also asked to step up for our communities when so much infrastructure was falling apart. This year, we were finally able to open the Games and Online Harassment Hotline to support the emotional well-being of folks who make and play games. We've already served people who have felt the effects of isolation and loneliness, of harassment online, of discrimination in the workplace, and the impacts of instability and uncertainty. You can help the hotline serve even more people because with your support, we can build the infrastructure to open for longer hours, to reach out to more communities, and get the word out to the people who need it most. So please, please, please consider donating today. You can visit feministfrequency.com/donate. All right. Dave, would you like to share with the audience who you are and why you're here?
Who am I? Well, I am here because you texted me last night while I was watching a movie and asked if I wanted to talk about it on a podcast. So my name is Dave, and I run a video game company called Mighty Yell. I'm also on the board at Feminist Frequency. What else do I do? What do? I do too much.
We're writing a screenplay together.
Yeah. I didn't know if that was public screenwriting.
Fine. They know.
Great. They know. I'm working on a game called The Big Con. It's a video game about being a young woman con artist in the mid-1990s. And
I love that.
Thank you. it's pretty fun.
I love that a lot.
Yeah, and you write screenplays, and you are an author, and you're a writer, and, you know, you do all kinds of fun, creative things.
Yeah, you said you didn't write me a bio, but that's pretty good.
And now you're here with us to talk about this Crackerjack movie.
I am here to talk about this Crackerjack movie. Yeah, I am pumped.
Y'all, one thing that Carolyn did offer us before being unable to join us was an article that is titled, Is Happiest Season a Horror Film? A Scientific Exploration.
Yes.
Which I was like, I don't even need to read more. Like, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She is not wrong. It is tense and weird and uncomfortable. But I do have to say something. I like Christmas movies, and like this worked in a lot of ways.
All right.
I cannot wait to get into it.
Okay, so let me give a little blurb about what the movie is, and then we can argue
and we shall
about the quality of this film. All right, Happiest Season, which dropped on Hulu in late November, is a new film from actor, writer, director, everyone's teenage lesbian crush, Clea DuVall. It's a quirky queer rom-com set during the madness of the Christmas season and boasts an all-star cast, including Kristen Stewart, Aubrey Plaza, Mackenzie Davis, Mary Steenburgen, Victor Garber, Dan Levy, and Allison Brie, and Mary Holland, who is also the film's co-writer. I'm not even going to do that one again. Mm-hmm. In the film, Stewart and Davis play Abby and Harper, a lesbian couple whose secret relationship threatens to expose the cracks in Harper's picture-perfect family and their own expectations of each other. All right, why is this a good Christmas movie? To convince me.
It's not great. Like...
Boom!
Episode
over.
I think it's actually super helpful to hear. I want to hear all the ways that it sucks. Because, like, I think a Christmas movie is always about how tradition, like, can solve problems. Which is why, and I'll say it in a public forum, Die Hard isn't a Christmas movie. But the...
Listen, Dave, you're not the one who's going to have to deal with the angry Twitter mob coming at
you. You can edit that part out. Just bleep it.
Okay.
No, that's Dave.
But it's...
Coming in hot.
It presented a problem, and a new problem, right? Like, it is a queer film, and used the very predictable tropes of Christmas movies, especially, like, pop Hollywood Christmas movies, to solve that problem. And, I don't know, it's a Christmas movie. Please, someone else say something.
What are your favorite Christmas
movies? So my favorites are like classics. I love like It's a Wonderful Life and the mm-hmm. Alistair Sim Scrooge. I really like Scrooged mm-hmm. with Bill Murray. And I love it because I also love like A Christmas Carol, like that the magic of Christmas. I'm such a sucker for this shit. Mm-hmm. But I think it satisfies, like, the Bill Murray one hits the emotional tones really, really well about the... Yeah. And it does so in such a way that, you know, it's not just... Like, the power of Christmas is incidental. It's actually about mm-hmm. giving a crap about other people. And that's why I think it's great. So, this is not on a pedestal with those films. But, like, I don't know. We can dive more.
So you think it works in terms of the expected structure of a Christmas
unbelievably
movie and
so.
The quality.
Yeah,
and
there's
the quality.
There's that sure. that one right. scene in like when they go to the skating rink and there's the sort of like tonal shift where they're about to race. It's this, you know, grafting on of hijinks that I think is a
what do you mean the tonal shift?
That's one. it's this crafting out of hijinks that like Christmas movies trade in, and I was like, okay, yeah, that mm-hmm. makes sense. I do think it has a lot
but
of,
but they're not
they,
good.
No.
But here's the thing: is that like everything that this movie tried to do to build tension and to like what you're saying, this grafting on of hijinks, which is a great way of describing it. I kept being like, oh, this is supposed to be a moment about something, and it's just not working. Like, the whole movie, I kept being like, oh, this is a moment. Oh, I see. Oh, okay, cool. Like, it's just, like, from the very beginning, I literally, my first two notes are BDSM Christmas couple, oh my God, this is trying so hard. Like, the every moment of it was just a little bit off. Like, it needed to be more fine-tuned in a way for me.
I love holiday movies, but, you know, like a lot of people, I'm left unfulfilled by the offerings that we get from, like, Hallmark and Lifetime, like, you know, the Christmas factory of movies that get churned out So there's, you know, a different TV movie, you know, every day during November and December. And it's 2 hours of white people in a small town discovering that they rather would be bakers than, you know, high-powered advertising executives in New York. You know, like, there's only so many of those I can watch. But I do love, you know, Scrooged and, you know, Jingle Jangle, new Christmas classic. Check it out if you haven't. Like, I do love that. I am, however, and how often do I say this on the show? I really should not be a co-host on this show because I'm terrible. I'm not the right audience for this particular movie because as much as I wanted to see like happy or not even happy, but just like lesbians, you know, celebrating the holidays and getting to, you know, do the same shit that people do in these holiday movies, I just didn't care about Abby and Harper as a couple.
But what about Abby and Riley as a couple?
Well, yeah, right? Like a lot of people, you know, if it had turned out that like Abby had hooked up with Riley at the end, I would have been completely satisfied. But Harper is given, like, she's such a, we get to see her doing things that demonstrate like that she's actually a good person and someone that you would want your main character to be in love with and be attached to for life before she starts acting out and letting us down and letting Abby down. And so like the central like conflict around which this movie rotates just didn't work for me. But also I'm not the right person for this movie because as much as I love romance, and y'all know I love romance, I read tons of romances, I'm not a huge fan of rom-coms. So I shouldn't even be talking about this movie. But I'm like, do y'all remember that episode, if you watch King of the Hill, where Hank was like, the problem with Christian rock is that it makes Christianity and rock music worse. I feel that way about a lot of rom-coms. Like the romance is unsatisfying and the comedy isn't funny. You know, like this movie was trying so fucking hard. And there were occasional moments where I did laugh out loud, usually because of like Barry Hotland, is hilarious as that sister, you know, like the forgotten sister. But you remember when like, I think there's like 2/3 of the way through the movie when Harper and her friends and her ex-boyfriend are at that bar. And it's this gross fratty. Exactly. Exactly my point, right? It's that what's perfect about it is that we can all relate to going back. Well, not all of us, but many of us can relate to going back to like our hometown for the holidays and ending up in like that one bar. And you're like, I'm too old for this town. I've outgrown this town, but this is what this town and this is what it has to offer, you know? And I was into that. But then the fact that the bar was named Fratty's just put a pin on it. And I was like, this movie throughout wants to tell me something is funny. It's like when someone tells you a joke and they're like, you hear that? Huh? You hear what I said? Like it doesn't trust the audience to find its own way. And so I was frustrated.
Yeah. I enjoy a really good rom-com. Mm-hmm. I just think there are so few of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's like a handful of really good ones and the rest of them are like this. And I don't have time in my life for this kind of shit anymore. You know, like it's so deeply unsatisfying to me because it's just not, it's exactly what you said. It's like you get that they made a joke, but it's not funny. Like I'm not laughing along with it. I also didn't really believe the central conflict or the character motivations for a huge part of this other than Abby. Like, I think Abby's character consistently made sense, although Kristen Stewart has one facial expression the whole time in everything she's ever done, and it drives me fucking bonkers.
Oh, man, I'm into it. I love it.
Yeah, but her character has one concern.
Whatever concern. But, one expression is, I'm a fan.
I hate it. But it also, like, because I hated this movie so much, and Abby was the only character that you could possibly have any sympathy for, really, I like, found myself drawn to her. Also, the outfit at the last party with the the like open collared shirt and the loose tie thing was so hot. Holy
shit. She's so good. Yeah.
I was like, I forgive all of your inability to act based on this one outfit.
No, there's a screenwriter on this film and there's a costume designer on this film, and they were both having separate but equally fun times for themselves.
Like, silly. So I feel like they are trying to set this thing up, right? So Harper hasn't come out to her family yet, which, like, you know, part of me is very eye-rolly of like, cool, we're going to have another story about like pretty white ladies who haven't come out yet. And that's going to be the central conceit here. I was also really angry, like angry that Harper gets forced out of the closet by her sister, and that that wasn't taken seriously, because that is a horrific thing to do to somebody. And it was just like used as a climax as opposed to recognizing how intense it is. And then you have a one-off note with a scene with Dan Levy, John, Abby's best friend, to explain to us, because the fucking story didn't do a good enough job of explaining to us about how like coming out is such an individual, personal thing in your relationship with your family and all of that kind of stuff. And that like, it can't be rushed and it has to be a personal choice. Right. But it's like one sentence and it's like one moment where it's, where it is explained in that. So like the reducing of the seriousness of that, I found really, really troubling. Well, sorry. And then just one more thing, the Harper as a character, like, we find out that Harper like lied about her high school girlfriend and like didn't come out of the, you know, didn't come out as queer, and threw her under the bus. But like you would think that over time, having, you know, at least come out to her friends outside of her hometown and like living an openly queer life, that she would like feel bad about it and feel a little bit awkward about her friends growing up that she like. Like, I just don't buy this.
No, because
like,
Harper's terrible. Whatever. We can forget about Harper. Can I ask you a question? Why does Riley still come to their Christmas party? After Harper did what she did in high school, I would pay you dust. I'm not coming to your Christmas party. I might come to your funeral just to pee on your grave. But I'm like, Riley, girl, why are you doing this to yourself? This woman is trash. She is trash. And for the record, I like Mackenzie Davis as an actor. Mm-hmm. Like, I really like her.
I love Mackenzie Davis.
Harper, just like, I saw nothing. There was nothing there. It was the most boring pile of oatmeal with no sugar, no cream.
Look, like, I think Mackenzie Davis played the character really well, given that she had a horrible character to play. Like,
I really thought they were setting up to disappoint us with Harper. Like, and I want to say, like, you know, I see a Christmas movie and it makes sense as a Christmas movie to me. It's not necessarily a good movie, or like it's doing too much and not really hitting everything that it needs to, you know, hit. I just want to say something really quickly about that Christmas party. I have had a white elephant party, like a white elephant gift exchange. And we're talking like 16 people. Jeez. That's too long. The idea of doing it with like 50 people.
With like stadium seating.
I was watching it with my wife. She said it's like a baby shower that doesn't end.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. I did a white elephant for the very first time last. Oh, that's okay. I did a white elephant for the first time last Christmas, and it was like 7 people. And like, it's a cool idea.
Is
but
it?
Like, you can't do for that many people.
No. White elephants are the worst. And if you are going to do one, I don't know, 4 people, you know, but it's tiresome also, after like the first 3 people go.
The whole idea of like stealing shit from people over Christmas feels gross. And also, there was one child when I was playing it, and I was like, this is not good to teach. Like, she's gonna get a thing and then it's gonna get taken from her, or no one will because they're a child. Like, it's just, I don't know. Anyways, that's
no, and inevitably
story.
It's like, you know, one person buys a PS5 and everyone else buys gag gifts, and so I mean, I guess I can see the appeal if you hate your family and hate your friends. I don't know, whatever. Why do I talk about these movies? I'm not the right person.
No, I don't think any of us are the right audience. I'm actually, Carolyn did not share with us whether she enjoyed it or not. And I'm actually really curious about what she thought.
And it's funny too, because I love everyone who's in this movie. I really do. Victor Garber, Mary Steenburgen, Anna Gasteyer, Kristen Stewart, you know, like Alison Brie. I love all of these people, but it did seem as if some of the people, some of the cast were in an entirely different movie than other folks. Like, some of them were like really leaning into the like really broad, wide comedy. And other folks were really, you know, mainly Kristen Stewart. And again, I think she is a fine actor. I think she's someone like Keanu Reeves who has like a certain kind of, I don't want to say range, but certain kind of affect. And Kristen Stewart is known for having like a kind of muted wry quality to her, which I really enjoy, but it was not right for this kind of movie.
Yeah.
You know?
No. I want to go back to motivation stuff here.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to say fratties.
Let's all go to fratties and do shots.
I'll go to that drag bar, though.
Can I talk about that drag bar really quick?
Yeah.
Like, yes, please.
So here's one of the things that I thought was heartfelt and interesting is that where the movie sets up so many different scenarios, like the part where we find out that Anna Gasteyer's character is there's stakes there too. The family has to be all perfect there too. When they added that layer, I was like, this movie's doing way too much. Like my brain is tired. But the core premise at the beginning of the film was Kristen Stewart doesn't like Christmas. She doesn't fit into Christmas. And I think they're for like queer cinema where like she has to find this version of, you know, whatever is representing her life in Christmas. And that's what I thought we were walking into. And there are parts of this movie that do it, which is why, you know, the fact that it's a poppy schlocky Hollywood Christmas movie, but centers around these two women, I think is like in some small way, a positive thing. We can still be critical about all the ways it fucks up. But the part where they go to the drag bar and she's like, I don't like this. I feel weird. And then she starts slowly singing Must Be Santa Claus, which I think is my least favorite Christmas carol, by the way. you can see like this moment of reflection where she's like, I see how this works for me. I see this space where I can be myself and have Christmas. And like that kind of worked for me. I like that. And that's also why I thought she and Riley Grant ended up together. Like, because,
listen, they absolutely have the best chemistry. There is a better version of
there's a lot of better versions.
There are several different versions, better versions of this movie. But there's a better version of this movie in which the whole coming out plot is excised. And, you know, the character of Harper is already out to her family. But the story revolves around, you know, Abby's, like, coming to, you know, like, grow and expand, you know, in her love and openness, both with her partner and with Christmas, you know, and like, you know, she goes to the family home and she's kind of oppressed by how overtly like cheery and jolly and picture perfect their Christmas celebrations are. The whole like, you know, political donor
gone and launched
subplot
to the
is completely cut out, etc. But it's exactly, you know, there's a better, funnier, sweeter movie there with Aubrey Plaza as Riley, as, you know, Harper, and Mackenzie Stewart is instead playing the villain, trying to maybe like steal one of the women away. I don't know. Like there's a better movie there. Or going back to what you said, Anita, and the link that Caro shared, there's a horror movie version of this that's also very good. I haven't read that link yet, but do they essentially say this movie is Get Out?
Oh, fuck.
Yes, because it is. It's come out, you know?
Like they're like the basement. Like
seriously, you know? Like when there's the scene of them driving to Harper's house, I was like, oh, okay, so we're going to do a little Get Out thing. And then Dan Levy's character, you know, on the phone is like the voice of reason, like the funny voice of reason. I was like, okay, yeah, so we're really, like, I know other movies doing it, but in recent memory, like Get Out has done it best. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, let me see like the horror movie version, you know, like a queer Get Out.
Yep, except that's not what we got.
It is not what we got.
I don't believe. So at the beginning, you're like, okay, Abby buys an engagement ring. I'm like, you two have no chemistry, but okay. And then like, I know you cut me off before, Ebony, but I'm going to keep going, even though you don't want to hear it. Like Harper, Abby doesn't know that Harper and her sister have this like tension and this like competitiveness. And I'm like, you want to marry this person and you've never met her family. Harper even says like, no, we're not, everything's fine. It's not intense with her. And you're like, what is happening? Like I don't get I get that people will have secrets and will hide things from themselves and other people, but like the particular ways that Harper is hiding things was really weird to me. The way that she was like, yes, I'll hang out with my ex-boyfriend a lot right now mm-hmm. while I wanted to bring my girlfriend here. And also the like, I was having such a fun night breaking onto people, like getting up onto people's roofs and stuff that I invited you to my parents' house without thinking about it and then didn't feel the need. Like the setup to me just felt so, I know like.
No, that's fair.
I know I should have a little bit of just like, okay, it's fine. It's a Christmas movie, but I just couldn't. Like, it just felt so stupid. And like, give me something more to like, give me something more to hold on to. Like every one of Ebony's suggestions would have made this so much better. Then you have go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like you talked about not knowing her family. I think just as Ebony said, there's a version of this where it's about finding family. I think this whole script, and I'll watch it again next year. Like, it's going to happen. Like, that's going to happen. But I think this whole script just bit off more than it could chew. In terms of thematically, we're going to talk about coming out. We're going to talk about how personal that is. But we're also going to talk about, like, family pressure. And we're going to talk about found family. And, like, any one to two of those themes. And I really think this structure could have knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
And I think it just tried for worse to do them all.
So yeah. You know what I think? Let me tell you what I think. Okay,
please.
You know how at the beginning I made the joke about Clea DuVall? It was mm-hmm. that Clea DuVall was so was one of the few like queer actors when I was like a young queer figuring shit out. And so there was a few movies that came out that like everyone, like every lesbian would latch onto, right? And like Clea DuVall was
a cheerleader.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And like there was a few others, right? And so Clea DuVall became this sort of like queer icon for a lot of lesbians. And so, you know, there's something special and exciting about Clea DuVall making a queer Christmas movie, I think. But it mm-hmm. feels like it's of that time. This movie feels like it should have came out in the late 90s or the early 2000s. That like narratively, socially, and not that people aren't still struggling with their families and aren't still coming out and that there aren't places for those kinds of stories. But I feel like I wanted more. I didn't want it to be a coming out story, first of all. I wanted to see the celebration and the joy and the conflict of Christmas. And you happen to be a queer couple doing that, you know? Yeah. Like, it feels a little dated to me.
Well, I don't think it's your place to say when the movie should come out.
Shut up.
I do think that, like, as much as I didn't, you know, personally, like, put on my sleigh bells and go marching around the house for this movie, I'm nevertheless glad that it exists, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
In an ideal world, we have so many queer stories on screen that we have room for the, you know, the mediocre, the fair to middling, the, oh, I'll put this on in the background, but I'm not really paying attention to it. You know, the ones where, you know, you only watch it for one character, whatever, you know, where each queer story doesn't have to be the end all be all. And so I'm happy for this movie to exist. I'm not like Dave. I'm not going to get the happiest season advent calendar. I'm not going to start cosplaying, Papa Caldwell, you know, but I don't judge him for those choices. You know, I just... Like I said, it's hard for me to know where I finally end up on this movie because I'm already going into it knowing that I'm not a huge rom-com fan. But just stepping back as like, you know, like a film fan, I'm thinking like, yeah, you know, I don't hate that this movie is out there. I do love that it's a queer story and that that's not like obscured, you know? Like that's central. There's no part of the messaging, that makes you think you're getting one thing, but you actually get another, you know, no lesbians die in the movie. Like that's still something that we can celebrate. And I'm glad that it's on Hulu, you know, like this is not locked away on, you know, some channel, that hardly anybody gets in their cable package. It's not something you got to pay $7.99 for to stream on Amazon. Like this potentially has been opened up to like a really huge audience. And so I'm glad for that, even though at the end of the day, I'm like, okay, were it not for this podcast, I probably would have turned it off halfway through.
I totally hear you. There's This is kind of where I fall on it. It's like, I feel like I'm glad that I think, you know, oh, Wonder Woman better do well or we'll never have another woman led movie before or after that. I think Christmas films are more forgiving in that regard. And there's a possibility that the fact that this exists and it is so 1998, means that it will have more broad appeal, right? Like, I think there's a version of this where we see this play out where more people that aren't expecting queer stories are going to take a chance on this. Like, I'm in a Christmas movie right now. I think there's a...
I love it. You're the guy who owns the Christmas tree lot. And you know what? I've come to you for a tree, but I came away with a little bit of wisdom.
A little bit of wisdom, right? Mm-hmm. I don't love how, like, manipulative and not cool Harper is as a partner in this for that story.
Yeah.
Like now we're looking at the one, like, potentially this becomes this massive queer story and a lot of people watch it and a lot of people are exposed to it. We're more accepting of queer stories showing up on Hulu or whatever. It's unfortunate that the romantic dynamic there is one of emotional manipulation and, like, kind of non-communication. That's a bit of a bummer. But that is also, to me, like a symptom of the movie doing too many things at once.
Yeah.
I would like to talk about the token Black husband and kids.
Let's do that.
Let's talk about that, but let's talk about how it did provide one of the few moments where I did laugh in the film when he comes in and says to, I think, Abby, like, if you put a little coconut oil on those
hands. I died.
And I was like, oh, love it. Anytime ashiness gets addressed in a film,
I literally just shouted, I laughed my ass off and shouted, why?
But I mean, let's be thankful, because when we first saw those kids, I know that y'all, like me, thought that it was going to be a situation where Sloane had, like, adopted some mixed race kids and that was going to be, like, you know, a comedy element. And I was like, nope, I'm not here
for
it.
Was surprised.
Not here for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so there's something about, like, this movie is so fucking white. And, you know, you could make the argument that, like, they're in the suburbs of what?
Pennsylvania?
Like, of Pittsburgh. Or Pennsylvania, somewhere in Pennsylvania. And that's probably true. Like, all the people that they grow up around are probably all white. But then you could make it not such a white film if you made the quote unquote outsider, which would be Abby in this moment, not white. Right. Like, so you're like, there's an expansion of, I moved to the big city and met other people potentially. Right. Like, so I just felt a little bit like, cool, I get it that, like, everyone you grew up around in this movie is going to be white, but, like, try a little harder.
I don't know. I mean, given what we got in this film, I do not want a person of color in that role. Like, this film already had too much dip on his chip. I'm not.
We're already doing all these thematic things. And then let's also do Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. It would be exhausting.
Fine. Well, it's true. It's true. I just think I've been thinking a lot about, like, what it means to like, if you're like, is it okay? Like, it really felt like the husband and the kids were, you know, people of color, because they're like, oh, whoops, everyone is white, right? Like, at some point are you like, well, cool, we'll just make this white movie and accept that it's all white folks, or do we actually, like, make an effort or what? You know, like, I don't know what the answer is to, like, there isn't one answer to it, but it still feels like in this day and age we should be a little more like, cool, how about doing a little bit more,
like, Harper,
a little bit better, you know,
not white. Like, there could have been a wealthy family of color living in the suburbs somewhere of Pennsylvania. Like, that's not unreasonable. And it would have been, I think it would have been fine. I think it would have actually been easier to take than if Abby was a Black woman or anything that wasn't just Kristen Stewart, very paleness.
But I think, like, that's this film is so deliberately, you know, using the template set by, like, you know, Christmas movies of yore, Hallmark, Lifetime movies of yore, right? Where it is it's overwhelmingly white. And that is the point of it, you know, like, there's this point about, like, America and family and the things that matter and love and relationships, that's all bound up into our ideas about like for which communities family actually matters, you know, who has access to capital. Because, you know, like another unspoken thing about these movies is that they're all heavily middle class, right? Like, it's very rare that you get a film where it's like, oh, here's some working class people, you know, some poor people, you know, getting down, celebrating Christmas. Like, obviously, we've got, like, you know, the, like, classics, like, you know, Dickens and stuff. But think about how few modern Christmas stories involve anyone other than, like, solidly, comfortably middle class and above folks, you know. Like, I don't think this story works with these people. Like, I think we would need to unpick all of the threads of this movie and completely weave it differently.
Yeah, I agree. The family's whiteness is critical.
Yeah.
To, like, who they are and what they're trying to do. I don't.
And I wouldn't mind, because, like I said, I love all these white people in this movie. These are some of my favorite white people.
She's like the queen of Christmas movies, you know, from. She's like the Jamie Lee Curtis of Christmas.
I love her so much.
With like One Magic Christmas and Elf. Oh, man. And like putting Mary Steenburgen in a movie is making a statement.
I feel like I need to get a list of like the good Christmas movies to watch. I've not watched a lot of Christmas movies.
You know
movies,
what? Maybe for Christmas 2021.
Except Die Hard. Die Hard.
Yeah, we do a 2021 like season of Christmas movies, and we watch a bunch of Christmas movies.
Oh,
and
that
we will
would be fun.
Let Dave curate that.
Let's do that.
Yeah, no.
And then we will know who to blame when things go left.
All right. Oh, can we be done with talking about this movie that was so boring?
Yes. And just once again, let me plug Jingle Jangle, which is so good. Y'all, if you need a Christmas movie, watch it.
All right, real quick before we move on to our freakouts. Earlier I mentioned that we just launched our end of year campaign, and I want to give you just one more reason to support us. This very show you're listening to right now, even if this episode was a little wonky.
People talk about why they hate Christmas.
We've had some good episodes, I'm just saying, you know? Anyways, in addition to the critical work we're doing to end abuse in the gaming industry, we have not forgotten our roots, demanding more just media representations, demanding accountability from media makers is as important as ever. And we've seen some remarkable improvements over the years, but the work isn't done yet. So please head over to feministfrequency.com/donate and donate generously to help us keep bringing feminist media criticism to the airwaves. That's feministfrequency.com/donate. Thanks. We'll be right back. Now it's time to talk about what's been thrilling us, moving us, upsetting us, or infuriating us this past week. And do I have a big one? I just completed last night a giant trilogy called the Dhavabad Trilogy by S.A. Chakraborty. And, okay. Ebony just told me that she had just started reading these books. Mm-hmm. They are massive. They're very big. There's a very big trilogy. Yeah. Okay. So it is basically Game of Thrones, except Middle Eastern with magic.
Yeah. Which parts of Game of Thrones?
By that you mean what? Break it down for me.
I will. Okay. As someone who did not finish watching Game of Thrones nor read the book, I'm making a lot of assumptions here. But the book foundationally is about the struggles and vying for power in a lot of ways, and but also vying to not be in power, right? So it starts with this woman named Nairi, who is in Cairo. She is basically an orphan. She has no memories from being a child, and she's a hustler. Like, she is, you know, day by day trying to figure out where her money's coming from, how she's going to buy food, what have you. And she has this weird ability to, like, understand people's illnesses. Like, she can touch someone and know what, you know, is it their liver? Is it blood pressure? Whatever. But, like, that's weird, right? She doesn't know what that means. And then something happens. A thing occurs, which then sets off the entire book. The thing that occurs really is that she learns that she is she is of magical people, and she's taken to her magical homeland. And that is the most spoilers I'm going to offer, because that's like pretty much like the first book, like little bits of the first book. Now, once you get into it, you realize that there are all of these different magical people. There's different magical creatures in this world. They all live like out of the, like humans are not allowed to know about them. And then when you get to this, like this, basically this magical land of magical people, you realize that there's been decades and centuries of turmoil and strife between all of the different cultures and all the different people. And so you, Nairi as the like outsider gets thrown into this space. And when I say it's like Game of Thrones, it really does have that like, who gets to be in charge of this land feeling, right? Who gets to control it? And there's a lot of like, there is a fair amount of machinations of power. Within like, what do you have to do to keep this, you know, to keep people in line, right? To keep folks in order. And how does the tension of oppression build up over time? How does mythologizing of history come into play in terms of how you understand your people and their place in the current world? So there's a lot of that happening here. And I found myself both gripped and frustrated by the book. Like there were, for example, the second book, I kept being like, this is kind of boring. I don't really give a shit about some of this stuff. And then all of a sudden, there's a point in the book where it flips for me and I could not put it down for like 2 days. Like I was up until super, super late. I would read first thing in the morning. Like I just couldn't stop reading it. And this trilogy did this to me several times. I think that the second book just kind of sits there in the middle, like in a trilogy often does, where you're building to bigness. And I also struggled a little bit with like, there aren't a lot of characters that you really like. Like everyone is very complicated. And I think that that's okay. It's just not really like, I don't usually get drawn to that because I want someone to root for, right? Like I want people that I like am super behind. And this makes everyone very complicated. And that's okay, right? And so there are moments where you're like, oh my God, you're a monster. And other moments when you're like, oh my God, I love you and want all the happiness for you.
That's a good book.
I recommend it if you want to just like fall into an incredible fantasy world. Like I finished it last night and I woke up this morning thinking about these people, right? Like I woke up thinking about like what are they going to do tomorrow, right? Like how are they going to like conquer the big things that they need to conquer and like, you know, be diplomatic and all of that kind of stuff. So the Dávabed trilogy. That's my freak out.
I love it. I love it. Like Anita said, I started reading the first book. I'm still reading the first book. And I love that if you are a fantasy reader, you are spoiled for choice when it comes to Western influenced or Western inflected fantasy. But if you are not interested in reading that, or you're interested in reading other things that don't have to do with like European magic systems, European cultural systems, you know, Western languages and peoples, they're vanishingly few options. They are out there and some of them are fantastic. I'm thinking of people like N.K. Jemisin, right? But there's nowhere near as many as there are just like, you know, Tolkien ripoffs.
Yeah.
So like, I love that I found this book. It is, you know, like, it's not something that you can skim read, at least if you're me, you know? Like, it takes concentrated attention because the world building is so dense and so rich that you find yourself being pulled very, you know, like, aggressively into the text. And so I'm taking my time with it. And yeah, I'm loving it. Loving it.
Sounds great.
So I just wanted to tag onto your freak out.
Yeah, of course.
I haven't read, like, a lot of the big, huge tentpole genre pieces like Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones, stuff like that. I did watch the show. But the idea of sitting down to read Lord of the Rings now is like, I'd rather put my hand in a paper shredder. I feel like I have read that book by walking through the world and breathing the air.
Exactly.
You know, like there's nothing that can do that would surprise me. And I want to pick this up now because this sounds like something that I haven't seen or read. And that sounds just great.
Yeah.
For the longest time, I thought I hated fantasy because I was so bored of that story. And it's been delightful over the years to be challenged on that, to be reminded that there are other ways of telling these like incredible stories that are just like, you just fall into them and you fall in love with these worlds and they're just incredible. And they're not all ripoffs of the same thing over and over again. Like this really... I remember when I read the first book, I was so delighted because I'm like, oh my God, this is like, you know, the shit that I grew up with, like the foods and the culture and like things mm-hmm. that I don't see very often in fantasy stories, right? Like, I don't think outside of like the Aladdin kinds of stories, we don't get a lot of like contemporary, like what Ebony said, I don't know why I'm repeating it, but for me, especially it being rooted in like Middle Eastern mythologies really resonated a lot. And that is entwined. It is like the air that this world breathes, right? In the clothing, in the food, in the weapons, everything is it, in the mythologies that are in the story are all being brought to light outside of the Western context. Mm-hmm. And I think for that reason alone, it's worthy of celebrating, but also it was just like, super fun to read.
Yeah. Love it.
Awesome.
I think Dave texted me last night, which is how we started talking about Happiest Season. He's like, how's your neck going? And I was like, I'm sobbing. I was full on sobbing in tears this one moment in the end. And I was just like, oh, what a good book that like it made me feel like I laughed out loud so many times. And I was just like, what a fucking treat to like feel, to feel
a treat to feel.
All right, y'all. Thank you so much for listening to Feminist Frequency Radio. Next week is actually our last week of the season, and we are going to be talking about Nomadland. And what we found out was that it is only available to watch if you buy tickets in advance. And we usually try to make sure that we're watching things that are more widely available, but you know, I thought it was going to be in wide release and it's not. So we're going to link in the show notes where you can find those tickets so that you can watch along and listen to the episode with us.
Cool.
Stay tuned for the freaking after party,
which we're going is to only Freddy's.
Available to backers of this podcast. You can learn. We're going to go to Freddy's for our after party. Yeah, totally. You can learn more at patreon.com/femfreak. The show is engineered by Rob Parra. Carrie Stimson provides technical support, artwork by Jamie Varon, and our intro music is by Phil Circus. Thanks so much for listening. Oh my God, I forgot one thing. If anyone made it this far, Dave, would you care to share where people can learn absolutely. More about you or
that's,
anything?
That's totally okay.
If you'd like still to listen. Do that.
You can find me at blank Dave on Twitter, which is where you can direct all your hate for my comments about whether or not Die Hard is a Christmas movie. You can go to, you can also follow Mighty Yell, MightyYell, to learn all about the big con. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody.